All right, welcome to The Hours. This is Savvy Coaching. I'm Tyler, that's Mark. I've got my farm shirt on. I'm still repping the brand underneath today. We're excited to spend close to an hour with you. The way that I've developed and grown as a coach is by spending hours and hours and hours with mentors. And one of my good friends, Sam Allen, actually has a phrase he's been saying as long as I've known him. He said, character is better caught than taught. And I would actually say the same for leadership and coaching. It's better caught than taught. You know, Mark and I can give you practice plans. We can make videos and courses, and that's helpful. But teaching, leading, it's better caught than taught. You can't substitute the time we spend together. And so that's why we love getting out on the road and doing clinics. In fact, Mark was just messaging me yesterday about a number of clinics for courtside coaches, because if you invest in us and invest in yourself doing courtside one-on-one coaching, you get a massive discount on all of our other products, including our in-person clinics. And so Mark was like, hey, we actually like won't make any money on these program clinics if we do it at this discount. And I was actually discussing with other teammate Claire, and it's like, yeah, and we want to do it anyway, because there's so much value to investing in those that are investing with us, growing the game. Like, so all that being said, we want to spend hours with you. And that's my second announcement, is a reminder. We announced it last week. This year, with Mark coming on board and partnering with us, we have the capacity to do coach workshops. And we're calling these workshops instead of clinics, because a clinic is where you sit down, get information, and take notes on a whole variety of topics that maybe apply to you, maybe don't. And whatever the clinician chooses to share, that's what you have no choice but to receive. And yeah, there's a throwaway Q&A for 2 minutes while they're being shooed off the court that you can't actually get into a conversation about. That's a clinic. It's information. It's like a seminar. We do coach workshops at Savvy. And what workshop is, like, we're going to actually get in the workshop, build tools with you, be interactive, going deep on one aspect or area of coaching for 3 hours, where you can actually go and be transformed in the tools you have and know exactly how to apply it. And you don't just have some notes where you don't really remember what they did on court. You actually have a plan. So our coaching workshops are happening, and our first one is happening here in Phoenix, Arizona. Me and Mark are both going to be here at the Final Four. Registration is live. Keep an eye on our social media, emails, it's gone out. We would love for you to come to our coaching workshop here in Phoenix. And this is a long second point, Mark, I apologize. And we want to bring a coaching workshop to you. If you would like one in your area, all you have to do is convince us that you can promote it and get 20 coaches there. And we will come and do one. We love major markets. We love easy access to an airport. We love if we can piggyback it onto one of the clinics that we're doing, whether we're speaking at a coaching clinic or doing a program clinic. Reach out directly. Reach out to Mark. Reach out to me. info@savvycoach.com. DM us, whatever. We are adding workshops as hosts convince us that they have a good location for us. And we love to do our workshops at like airport hotel conference rooms, or if you've got a really nice, comfortable gym. We hate to do it in bleachers because I don't want to sit in bleachers for 3 hours. But if we need to be able to walk to court, we can do that as well. Those are my two announcements. Mark, anything to add to either of those things?
Yeah, I'll tell a quick story and then I'll add something. So I attended a Nike clinic, and I think the fun thing is about what athletic directors will write a check for is like, hey, I'll send the staff to a clinic, and it's, you know, $100 for each coach, the travel and all that. And no one blinks an eye. Our thought process is the clinic comes to you. You can pick the topic, right? You we're all like-minded, so we know it's going to be applicable. So anyway, my AD sent me to a Nike clinic. And, you know, the Power 5 Division 1 coaches give the same speech every time. Well, this Power 5 coach, we were at a casino. I've been known to gamble a little bit. And 20 minutes in, he just told, like, story of his childhood. And it's like, great. And I looked at the group I was with, and I was like, I'm leaving. I just got up and left. And I actually caused, like, like a barrage of people leaving. We had to go like literally shut the doors and keep people in. And no disrespect to that coach, awesome coach. Just, you know, he was using his clinic as story time. So I've done coach workshops all over the country, and the feedback has been incredible. So let us come to you. You pick the topic, you drive the conversation, and bring any coaches that you want, your whole staff, buddies that you want, just promote it in the area.
That's really that. It's so true. And like, and addition, this is what I love about you, Mark, and what I identified the first time I heard you present. A good coach does not equal a good presenter or a good coach educator. Like someone like, and probably the coach that you're talking about has probably been very successful and is unbelievable with their team. It's a whole nother skill set to then develop coaches or be an engaging speaker or teacher. It's a whole nother skill set. And, you know, I know that Mark and myself, we spend all of our time trying to master that skill set. We don't spend the majority of our time any longer trying to master the art of coaching a team. We spend our time researching, developing systems, actually doing the work of coaching coaches. And as you know, the more that you use a tool, the better you get with that tool. And so it's a whole different skill set. And we're just committed to being our absolute best at this skill set, at being coach consultants, teaching coaches, developing coaches, and helping you. So we hope that we can help you in that. Mark, did you have anything else on that? And did you end up winning at the tables?
Gosh, I don't have anything else to add, and I'll just go with no.
Okay.
Probably not. I mean, hate to say yes, this is a long time ago. I do gamble enough where I know my way around a casino. I know what I'm doing, but I'll just go no, just to be modest.
I mean, you know, false modesty is actually arrogance, but I'll share this. So this here, I got into this habit. So for those of you guys that don't know, let me see if I can pull this up here. Okay, good. For those of you guys that don't know, oh gosh, I am an avid gambler. And I mean, really, I mean, every time you wake up, you're gambling, aren't you? You step out into, you know, you drive a car, you're gambling, all of these things. So I'm an avid gambler. So these chips are actually all memories. And I'll have to tell the story of some of these chips. But these are all chips. These are all chips from casinos that I am actually no longer allowed to gamble at. Which is interesting. And so I always take a chip when, yes, thank you, that when I get kicked out of the casino, but that's another story for another time. Mark, go ahead. Yes.
We might've had this conversation before. Actually, if I want something a little bit faster pace, love blackjack too. Blackjack is very system based, right? Like there's a lot of value in being consistent, and kind of have an identity of who you are as a blackjack player. Poker is, you know, you kind of have your identity, but you can change based on how the table changes, right? I find my experience with poker really helped me as a coach as far as identifying outs, like how to maximize your outs and being okay with losing with your identity. So if I put my chips in, if I push my chips in, I have the best hand, you know, and the turn or the river go against me. It's just like, what else could I do? You know, like, I don't know the next cards in the deck, like, okay. Understanding trade-offs, understanding that things are not zero sum, I think really, really helped me as a coach. And I probably didn't realize it until way later in my coaching career.
I completely agree and love that. I'm actually looking at my bookshelf right now to see if I have the book that I want to reference out. I'm going to go grab it actually. Mark, let me ask you this. Do you think that passions outside of basketball, whether it be gambling, whether it be like, you know, what you might learn from, you know, poker or blackjack, whether it might be music, whether it might be art, whether it might be like, you know, long distance running. Do you think that all of those pursuits actually help you develop as a coach? If so, why or why not? And I'm going to grab a book.
Got it. Some of my other, I actually love music. I think when you're doing something else, even if something's mindless, it helps you. You have those like shower thoughts, right? But I also think something like exercise is really good because one, you alleviate stress, all those things. But I think it helps you develop discipline. I like to work out. I lift 4 days a week and I try to do something active every single day. And I think it's just the practice of being in routine, the practice of challenging yourself. And then, and I think if you're going to be a coach, I think there's something to be said for being in shape and being able to do a lot of things that you're teaching your team. But I think also just, here's where it helped me. It's kind of weird, but when I would lift, when I would work out, I'd be sore. I would realize I wasn't going to be at 100% physically every day. And I think it helped me relate to my players too of, hey, whatever you've got in the tank today, that's what we need. But I understand you're not robots. Every day's going to be a little bit different, whether that's emotionally or physically. So I think just doing other things, I consult with coaches that don't do other things. And honestly, I think their identity gets wrapped up in being a coach where they wear the wins and losses much more extreme than somebody that has more balance. You know, coaching is something that you do, really. It's not hard.
Yeah. I'm so glad you went there. And the more you can separate coaching from who you are, I think the more successful you'll actually be at it. You know, for example, my dad's a professional golfer. He's played on, he likes to joke, he's played on every tour, but the women's tour, he had his PGA Tour card for years, Champions Tour. I've gotten a caddy for him in US Opens and PGA Championships. So he's been, you know, very successful by like a layman standard. But he would say that he always fell short because he never won on the PGA Tour. He was always kind of going between having his card and not having his card. And he would say this, that the biggest thing was he never fully tapped into his potential because he always battled with golf being his entire identity and value, which how that played out for him and often I think plays out for athletes at all levels and coaches at all levels is when you feel stress or pressure, when the stakes are the highest, the closer the outcome is to your identity, the more it negatively impacts your performance. I mean, the most, I think, visceral example of that is shooting a basketball, right? The more the outcome of the shot is tied into your identity as a player, the harder it is to perform under pressure. Whereas the more your identity is actually separate or secure from the outcome of a single shot, that's where clutch performers rise to the occasion. That would be your Steph Curry, right? Like Steph, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say poker in that you can fall into the trap very quickly as a poker player or a coach or whoever you are to be very outcome oriented, right? I made this decision, I lost that hand, so I'm not making that decision again. Could have been the right decision, or I made this decision, it was the wrong decision, and I won, so I'm going to be more likely to chase the flush draw on the next one, right? Even though I only had five outs and ended up hitting it. So yeah, I was just going to say that. Also, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but this might be a dead end comment, but it made me think of this whenever you mentioned golf. Here's the interesting thing about golf to me and in golfers' careers is their career is so long, but their prime seems to be like such a small slice of that pie.
Mm-hmm. That is fascinating. I had not actually considered that. I'd love to talk about that with my dad. I'll share a bit of my dad's story here because this is our podcast. And so I hope that there's entertainment as well as education. So I started caddying for my dad on tour when I was 12 years old. All right. So this is actually a newspaper clipping of me caddying for my dad when I'm 12 years old. And like the thing is like, oh, Tyler's thrilled to be kept. Yeah, I just, you know, you can tell I was tired. That bag is as big as me. So I've been around Like I tell a story like of when I peed next to Tiger Woods and we had a deep conversation, like when he was in his prime, actually. So I've been around high performers, more so in golf than basketball. Like, you know, I've been around a handful of performers, but I've been around high performers, more so in golf. And, you know, what I've noticed and observed is like in that length of career, like it doesn't matter how far removed from their prime they are, they still believe that they can achieve it again. You know, they really do believe it. And I think that's the one thing that I've observed of just like greats at every level. So I thought I'd throw that one in there.
Yeah. And I distracted you. Did you want to finish your Steph Curry?
No, I think I'm done with it, actually. Okay. I think I'm done. And actually, Mark, let's do this if you're okay. I'm just getting a notification. I need to bounce and check on Steph real quick. Could you go into the our shots piece, and I'll chime back in here in a moment?
Yeah.
All right. Yep. Thanks, man. I'll be back.
Yep. So Tyler's wife, Stephanie, celebrate Tyler for being on the hours today. I told him I would take it solo, but he wanted to be here with y'all. So last podcast, we were talking defense and lock left versus pressure man to man. The last stint that I had as a coach, we ran pressure man to man, meaning no middle defense. We influenced the ball to the sideline when above the free throw line extended, and below the free throw line extended, we influenced it to the short corner or the baseline. And we switched everything, which is very similar to lock left. And the interesting part about partnering with Tyler is that I would say our philosophies are very much in line, but strategy and tactics differ. So we really get to the same place. We just get there by going a different route. So we were comparing our shots, our space, our time, our people, meaning our shots, which shots do we like offensively, which ones do we take away or give up defensively, our space, you know, offense hunts space, defense tries to restrict space. So how do we do that in pressure man to man versus lock left? And I can't remember exactly where we left off, but I love the conversation. And we said we were going to continue it today. So I'll start with space. Obviously, no middle defense. We like to take away the middle of the floor. The big difference in lock left is that when the ball's on the right side of the floor, you're actually allowing the ball to go to the middle of the floor, but it's on your terms, right? It's going to the left. We're about to enter the best 2 weeks, 3 weeks of the basketball season, right? March Madness is coming. I'm always interested to see what systems teams are running. Seems like more teams are more gap-oriented now, but I always look at, can I find out where they're influencing the ball? Are they going to the middle? Are they, is defense influencing to the baseline, or are they just playing straight up? So our space that we would take away would be the middle of the floor. I think if we watched basketball over the next 3 weeks, we would find more turnovers on baseline drives than any other drive on the floor. So that is the answer to our space. I don't know how much you've caught of that, if you want to piggyback in or
I just heard baseline drives, and one influence in my coaching is a guy by the name of David Thorpe. He wrote a book called Basketball is Jazz. I don't know if you've read it, but I just remember when he was live tweeting from NBA Summer League, and he was talking about young guards coming out of college playing at the pro level for the first time. And he was tracking how many turnovers came from baseline drives when they leveled up. And it was just like, it was over 50% of their turnovers. And he just kept like going off, posting pictures. He's like, the baseline is death. The baseline is death. So especially if you are going up against a really tough defense, especially if you're not like a LeBron James or Giannis type of physicality, that's one of the things that I just call 50-50 plays, which is probably like one of the main teaching points that we'll get into in this practice plan, is teaching players what this is, what a maybe pass is, what a maybe drive is, what a five shot is. If we can eliminate these, if we're going back to thinking in bets, if we can eliminate these, efficiency goes up massively. And I think if you can identify those things, like, okay, us not grabbing loose basketballs, us not peeking at the rim the moment we touch leather, us making baseline drives, us playing off of one foot against contact, all of these things, like you will have greater impact and your efficiency if you eliminate these things than if you add this new action or whatever else it is. So you're just preaching right now.
Yeah. And then, you know, similar to Lock Left, it's like we're determining this. We'd play gap the other way because that's where we're funneling the ball. And I think having a clear system eliminates the maybes, right? Can we, I liked teaching an if thens, and on defense, I think we can make it fairly binary, right? I think offense, you have to embrace the gray area of the game and the decision-making. And, you know, was that like, even last time when the hours we were looking at some film, and the longer we watched the shot, we were like, maybe that is a five, right? Maybe that's not a, you know, so there's so much gray area offensively, but defense, can we make that really, really binary, clear set of rules, clear set of expectations to provide clarity? Because there is so much gray area in the game.
If you got more, keep going, Mark, or we can transition your call.
I would like to hear your thoughts. So we talked about our shots last time. I just touched on our space. I would like to hear your thoughts on our time.
Cool. I'll go offense first. Okay. And then completely contradict myself on defense for the first, not the first time, but for a less frequent time. Our time. So in tracking the programs that I've worked with, similar to what we are now doing through Courtside, but I've worked with individually and in person over the past 5 years. In tracking that, what we have found, and I actually, this is in our new transition mini course, which will be shared here shortly. We have found that teams score 50% more efficiently. So like if they're overall points per possession is 0.85, okay? We find that they would score closer to like 1.25, right? 50% more, 1.25 points per possession when they get a shot up in the first 7 seconds of the possession. So therefore, our time is the first 7 seconds of the possession, regardless of whether you have a shot clock or not. So that's why I'm saying possession instead of shot clock. Now, we know that we can assume that there's nothing magical about shooting quick, but there's other things that are often occurring in the first 7 seconds. So usually, if you have a leak out breakaway, which is probably wide open layup, which is the most efficient shot in basketball, those always happen in the first 7 seconds. So you're gearing it that way. But if we measure it and say, hey, we want to try to shoot the first 7 seconds, what I found is players get more breakaways. They're bolting faster. We're looking up, like, because we train this level of pace and urgency. The second thing that often is happening is you're going to get numbers advantages in the first 7 seconds. That's one of the few times where you're going to actually have a built-in numbers advantage, especially if you're racing the arcs. Another thing that happens is most teams don't teach transition defense very well. Most coaches don't teach, and teams don't execute transition defense. So there's a moment in time, and you can't always take advantage of it. You don't always play fast enough. You don't always, you know, hunt it and recognize it well enough. But there usually is a moment in time where there's some level of disorganization. Two players are on the ball. One player doesn't see the ball. One player is hanging their head because they didn't get a foul call. Right? Coach is yelling and screaming at a player, and so they're distracted for a moment. Parents are yelling and screaming at a player, so they're distracted. There's a moment of disorganization. And offensively, if we walk the ball up the court, we won't be in a position to take advantage of that moment of disorganization. So that's why we teach race first and race always. That doesn't mean we're going to take a quick shot. That just means we're in position to take advantage of something good. That's being opportunistic, right? It's like, you know, when we're counting cards in blackjack, you know, we're not always going to make a big bet, but when there's an opportunistic moment and there's more aces and faces left in that deck than small card, we're going to slam that bet. And we're there, we're ready to take advantage of something good if we get a double down or a split or whatever. So that's really our time's first 7 seconds. Teams tend to score about 50% more efficiently in that first 7 seconds. That's our time on offense. Before I flip to defense, our time, anything you want to add or contrast or disagree with there, Mark?
I agree with all of it to be the same. And basically what I said while you were gone was the cool thing about our partnership has been our philosophy is the same. Sometimes our strategy and tactics differ, but we're all going to the same spot, right? Here's the way we articulated it is if we were going to face a lock left team or a pressure man-to-man team or a zone team, a pack line team, we never wanted to feel that. We never wanted our opponent's defensive philosophy to set in, especially if that's what they did well, right? A lot of the teams that we consult with or break down film for, they'll say, hey, this team does a really good job of, I don't know, they pack it in the paint in this 3-2 zone and make it really difficult. Well, the easiest way is to never face that or limit the amount of times that you face that defense. So, yeah, completely agree. That's the way we wanted to play. My favorite phase of offense is, I mean, I love transition, but I think the prettiest form of basketball to me is that early offense phase where you might get the ball down the floor, you crack the shell, you drive, kick, click, 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 drive, kick, three, where it's not quite in that, it might not even be in the first 7 seconds, but that racing in those first 7 seconds created the advantage, and then you kept the advantage until you got your shot. So we called that early offense, where it wasn't transition, but we didn't get really even into an offensive action. We just flowed right into that like middle ground of the possession. Prettiest football to me.
Agreed. And that would be why we race every time. So a novice coach would say, we raced and didn't get a layup. We didn't get anything out of it. Well, then that novice coach has not yet taught the most important aspect of racing, which is, can you continue to flow with speed from your race into your advantage game, or what I've been calling dominoes? I think I may have gotten that term from you recently, Mark. Like, you race for advantage. If that advantage results in a 9 or a 7, great. But as you play better and better teams, it will result in a 9 or a 7 less. But you still build a race for the advantage, and that advantage that you create off of your race and your spacing or arriving in shape, as you say, Mark, will actually deliver you a better advantage than any action that you run, any action you run. And so I would just caution all coaches here, don't get distracted with the fascination of another action or moving the chess pieces around. Like, I understand that it's fun. Any effort and focus you spend on that thing, it's a zero-sum game. You have X amount of hours and seconds and minutes. Any amount of time you spend on those actions are hours that you're taking away from this thing, racing, arriving in shape, recognizing your advantage, creating your double and triple gaps. Mark, I sent you, I've been studying soccer a lot recently, and more of their approach to teaching soccer, because in soccer, you don't run plays. In soccer, you don't run plays, but you do teach principles and how to play. And so, you know, this is I'm trying to remember the phrase. It's about like a surfing and wave. Like when the waves crash, you kind of like go under the wave, break the wave, maybe is what it was called. I don't know. But they were showing a rondo. A rondo is just a small sided game in soccer. They're showing a rondo, a 5v3 rondo, where they were trying to keep their space and move the ball quickly from side to side in order to stretch the defense. And the ball movement is what they're calling the wave. Well, what they were trying to teach their players is when to break the wave and punch the gap, right? They called it breaking the wave. I love the concept. Well, that's essentially what you're trying to do in your 7 second game, is you're trying to move the ball both vertically and horizontally. Vertically first, cross the street, horizontally second, right? You're trying to create a wave to stretch the gap, and then you want to punch that gap. And teaching that, and this, oh, there's another beautiful concept that was being talked about. We often, as coaches, try to teach individual catch reads to players to read closeouts, right? Which we would call, you know, attacking a gap or driving a closeout or whatever. What the best soccer coaches in Europe right now are talking about is not just the player who receives the ball learning how to break the wave and punch the gap, but can an entire team recognize that moment together? So when Mark catches and breaks the gap, I am not caught by surprise in the right corner. I'm not caught by surprise in the porch. I'm not caught by surprise on the 45, right? I see it at the same time you do. And so I can then operate in space as well with a burn cut, with a blast, with a fill or whatnot. That's beautiful. And I think that's next.
Uh-oh. I think Tyler froze on us.
Moment. Go ahead, Mark.
All right.
Shoot. Am I back? Okay, cool. Anyway, go. Yeah, so that is a concept that I am committed to exploring and getting better at, because I have not taught that well or raised that awareness. I've only taught the first person, shooter vision approach to, can you shoot a driver or move it? But can we recognize that moment and then teaching everyone what to do?
I'm going to add to all three in reverse order. So
love it.
Closeout reads kind of an individual versus team understanding. Here's something that we talked about, and I think it's the sweet spot in conceptual offense, because coaches that are learning race and space or drive in space or just conceptual offense in general from a traditional offense, they want more freedom, but they want structure within that. And I think the sweet spot is giving players options, right? Where if I have the ball, I can do A or B. If I don't have the ball, I can do A or B. And we can all read off each other. A principle of play would be the player above you tells you what to do. I always told coaches this: conceptual offense done right gives players enough freedom to where they can make plays for themselves or their teammates, but they're also not on an island. There's, and I'm not criticizing dribble drive, but I talked to dribble drive coaches for the last 5 years, and what they are wanting is, they say, well, the player in the left corner or the player with the ball, they just feel like they're on an island and they don't feel connected to their teammates enough. So what we help coaches do is bring that connectedness that you're talking about, where if Tyler gets that catch, well, I know what Tyler excels at. So I have a good prediction, or I can anticipate what Tyler's going to do next. And I can either create more space for him, create an advantage, or just hold my spot in the corner. I love that you're studying soccer. I have been too. You shared a really good article with me a month or so ago that I really enjoyed, and I've stayed studying soccer. What I love about soccer, no plays, like you said, it is all spacing and ball movement, right? And then they pick that right opportunity. Heard this too recently, is like a cross in soccer. You typically score more on those horizontal passes in soccer. So I've been trying to think of like basketball terms as like an early opposite pitch, or a skip pass would be the equivalent of a cross in soccer. And then last thing, you talked about arriving in shape or spaced and organized, allowing you to flow seamlessly from full court to half court, right? Because offense should begin as soon as you get possession of the ball, like you're saying, right? We're going to race the entire game. We're about to enter the best part of basketball. I said this while you were away. These next 3 weeks are going to be awesome. I always like to help coaches shape their lens in which they see the game through. So I want to raise awareness to this. Watch the NCAA tournament, and we've talked about the difference between college and pro, and this is one of the biggest differences between colleges and pro basketball. Watch the tournament and see how many teams may look to push in transition. If they don't get a shot they want in transition, maybe a 7 or a 9, they stop, they slow it down, they set it up, get a call, and while they're doing that, defense is setting up. They're getting their principles in place, their philosophy, and now it's neutral basketball where you've lost that sweet spot, like I was talking about, in between transition, half-court offense to attack. You don't ever see that in soccer, right? It's just very free-flowing, and we talked about the Euro influence of soccer and basketball and stuff, so we won't get into that. But as you watch the NCAA tournament, take note of that every time a team looks to go in transition, don't get transition, they stop, they set up and allow defense to get set up as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Love all of that. Let me give a tangible challenge to coaches. Don't call a timeout at the end of the game when you get the basketball with a 7-second opportunity. So, for example, let's say you're down, you know, one bucket or less at the end of the game, and you defensively get a stop, or even the other team scores, but you're still within one bucket. I would encourage you, do not call a timeout, especially if you have 7 seconds or more left on the clock. Stretch into thinking in bets and allowing your team to attack in transition, because nothing else that you draw up, especially in a full court situation or from the sideline near half court, is going to create as big of an advantage for you, especially if you've been teaching the principles all season long, as your race in hunting an advantage in transition. We will result a lot as coaches be like, oh, well, last possession, I let them go in transition and we turned it over. We didn't score. We didn't run anything. Okay. All I think would be faulty narratives. The question would be, you know, thinking in bet, do we have a better chance at creating an advantage or not? And I firmly believe and would encourage everyone to consider, hey, we don't call a timeout. So like my check downs when I'm coaching, and this is why I love getting to coach these club teams, they get to experiment with all this stuff. My check downs are 7 and 11. So when we're down at the end of the game, I will not call a timeout in the first 7. We're attacking. After 7, I'll see, okay, are we flowing quickly into our 11-second offense or our first action? If we don't flow quickly, then I probably will call a timeout, right? Because if we don't flow with speed, I don't think we're going to create as big of an advantage as if I were to actually position the pieces a little bit more and get my best players in their best spots and align the wave, if you will. But if we flow quickly into 11, I still won't call a timeout. And then I'll allow the 11-second action to try to create some dominoes for us. If we don't get into dominoes out of that 11-second, then I would call a timeout to then try to structure some sort of advantage again. 3 months ago, and then I'll throw it to you, Mark. 3 months ago, there were, let me get this as accurately as I can remember. We had a baseline inbounds with 7 seconds left. We were down 3. Baseline inbounds, our end, 7 seconds left, down 3. We didn't do anything new. We just ran our normal stuff for an advantage as a youth team. We caught the basketball on the left side. Our best player caught the basketball on the left side, and it was absolute chaos, disarray. As you can, this was a youth team. This was 5th and 6th graders. As you can imagine, just absolute chaos for the offense and defense. So, I mean, I don't know how many players were swarming the ball. Our spacing was terrible, whatever. And I'm freaking out. I'm like, okay, this is not good, whatever. I turn to the referee to call a timeout. And as I do so, all 3 players on the ball, for whatever reason, ran away from the ball because it's disorganized youth basketball. As I call the timeout, player with the ball, because they had picked it up, they were being trapped. Player with the ball pivots back, releases the shot. As the shot is released, referee awards me the timeout. Bucket, nothing but net. Our team goes from exultant, right, to then the referee's like, no bucket, timeout, pointing at me, right? And the girl that hit the shot looks at me and just starts bawling. I stole that shot from you. I'm sorry. I didn't trust the chaos enough in that moment. It's a tough value judgment and all that stuff. But like, I doubled down again. I'm like, you know what? I went against the principle of like, allow the chaos. I think we're still in the 7 seconds there. Like there's still a little bit of chaos there. Like, what am I going to run? And so it just encouraged me.
What I love about that is I love that you're connecting the 7 second and 11 second offense to your special, your philosophy on special situations or late game strategies. I find coaches will have an offensive philosophy, and then I actually find a lot of coaches don't have a late game or special situation identity. They should be the same. We actually did the same thing. We had what was called the 8-second rule. One possession game, all of our coaches, all of our players knew above 8 seconds, we're rolling. Below 8 seconds, we're likely calling a timeout. And our thought, same thought process as you, I'm sure, is with 8 seconds or more, we have time to rebound, push the ball. We're not going to get something great, timeout, and we still have enough time to operate sideline or baseline out of bounds. I got that from Kevin Stallings years ago, and I find that that was just a good rule of thumb where every game I didn't have to make a crucial decision. My assistants knew we were all on the same page, and our players knew. It's kind of like I have two LSU stories because I went to LSU. Big fan. Was watching LSU South Carolina and in Sunday and in the NCAA tournament. SEC tournament championship. Under a minute, you can advance the ball. Obviously, in the women's game, you can't dribble or pass it. And Angel Reese was looking to the sideline saying, like, hey, timeout. Like, they were at the free throw. South Carolina was shooting free throws. She's asking, like, just double-checking, like, timeout, right? So whether they had that, you know, every time we're calling a timeout or whatever it is, seems like they had that in place. They were just looking for affirmation there. And then the second thing is LSU men's basketball won a close game a couple weeks ago. They did not call a timeout. They took it the length of the floor. They got the ball into their best player's hands. They got him into a ball screen and he ended up coming off the ball screen, making a heck of a pass to a teammate, and they won the game. A buddy of mine texted me and said, like, hey, man, I know it worked out, but I just don't understand why our coach refuses to coach in those situations. And I had to explain to him as to the novice eye, doing things equals coaching, right? Mm-hmm. Like yelling and screaming and calling timeouts and calling plays, that equals coaching. And I could argue the opposite, right? I could argue the more you have to do in the game, the less prepared your team is. And by telling your players what they should be doing all the time, you actually make your players worse. But I also had to explain to him, well, we got the ball into our best player's hands, into the action that we were going to run out of the timeout anyway, but we didn't let them set up their defense, change their defense, change their ball screen coverage, sub in better defenders. So many variables in there that actually coaching was not calling the timeout instead of calling the timeout. I say all that, coaches all have their own philosophy, and whatever yours is likely fine. But I would just say have a philosophy and know that coaching is not always doing something.
Yeah. I'm so excited for all of our coaches to hear this episode. One, remove decisions as a coach. Remove decisions. You will be a better coach the more decisions you remove. Let me give three examples. And I hope, like, all these things that you experiment with them and they hit and they continue to grow your coaching philosophy. One, sub decisions. Remove sub decisions as much as possible. As a head coach, there's simple ways to do that. One, just assign that to an assistant. If you want to make an edit in game, you definitely can. But I found that if you're thinking about your sub decisions, you're not as present on any.
Come back, Tyler. You're frozen again.
And this is probably one that I get the most pushback on, is pre-scripted. I believe your players will perform better and you will have less to worry about if players actually know when they're going in for and who they're going in for. There's a Second Spectrum Sports did a really interesting study on the myth of the hot hand. So it's like, oh man, I don't want to take Mark out right now. He just hit 2 threes in a row. Absolute myth. So interestingly, what happens is with the hot hand theory, is with every consecutive make, the expected field goal percentage of the next one goes down. Interestingly enough, it goes down. And here's why. Heat checks. When someone has the hot hand, you're like, then eventually they shoot further out, more and more contested, right? And so with every consecutive make, the difficulty of shot based on distance from the rim, based on contest, based on, you know, balance, all that stuff, the expected field goal percentage actually goes down. And so when people have a hot hand, they tend to shoot harder and harder shots until inevitably and predictably they miss. And so that's actually where, when you game it out over time and over large numbers, each consecutive make after two. Each consecutive make after two, there's like a sharp drop off where they might make three or they might make four, but they're likely to miss and then to try to find it again and shoot another bad shot. So with the myth of the hot hand, I feel like, we don't want to take Mark out. He just hit two shots. I feel like that argument, for me at least, is a lot less weight. So I actually like to pre-script subs. I like to earn playing time throughout consistency and performance and practice. I like even throughout the season for people to know this is our rotation, right? Like you're our starting racker. You're like, I'll go college numbers. You're likely to play 32 minutes a game, right? You're our backup racker. You're likely to play 8 minutes a game. And here's when it's happening, right? You're going a 4 minute stretch between the first and second quarter and a 4 minute stretch in the third and fourth quarter before they come back and finish the game. That's what's happening. You know, game breaks might flex that by 30 seconds either direction, but people know that's what's happening. And then you can have some variation within that. But as you get to higher and higher levels of play, inconsistent performances like, oh, they just don't have it tonight. Inconsistent performances like that and large variation actually happen less and less. And a lot of times a player missing two shots or making two turnovers as a coach will, I think, imperfectly understand that is they don't have it tonight. Whereas if you just continue to allow them to play, it would probably even out over time. Players are who players are. And, you know, if two of the turnovers get compressed into a 1 minute period, so be it. They're likely going to have the same turnover rate over time. So that would be another decision that you want to try to eliminate. Maybe two specific ways to eliminate it. One less drastic, just assign it to an assistant coach. One more drastic, pre-script everything. Before I go on to the next decision, Mark, do you have anything to add on that one?
Yeah, I'll say hot hand theory. At first, I was like, wow, interesting. And then when you said heat check, I'm like, taking a tough shot. You miss it. It's like, it was a heat check. And everybody's like, oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Okay. He said heat check. with subs, I had a one-on-one call with a coach yesterday. We talked about developing a playing time system for him because as coaches, we know playing time is going to be an issue, whether it's a major issue, a lot of minor issues, disgruntled people, whatever. Have a system for it. I like to be really proactive in my approach where you're just saying, hey, these are the amount of minutes you're likely going to play. When you're not proactive, when you're not clear, when you're not honest, that's when players are really, really upset or parents are waiting for you in the parking lot or you get because they go to the game expecting Johnny or Susie to play 25 minutes and they play five. That's when they're really upset. Four types of minutes that I would encourage coaches to communicate with their team and start thinking about. One, rotation, like you said, this is just the rotation. Two, based on performance. Three, based on behaviors. Tyler is not himself today, or he's too high, he's too low, his minutes will be cut. And then last would be situational. Defensive sub, end of game type of things. What does the game situation call for? I think when you explain to players, those are the minutes that are available and where they fit in, I think you're going to get a lot more harmony among the group. Even if they disagree, at least they know where they stand.
Yeah, really good. Okay, man, we it's crazy. There's just so, that's why we need hours of this stuff. All right, I'll just give the other two. We won't go as deep on them. We've already gone pretty deep on one. It's actually what triggered this is end game. Like remove end game situations. Like Mark's 8 second, my 7 second, like you know, your assistants know, you don't have to think about it. Should I call a timeout, right? So like in-game situations, when do we push it, when we call in a timeout? In-game situations, do we foul when we're up three? Would be another, like just pre-scripted. Don't try to game it out. Just decide, are we doing this thing or are we not doing this thing? When do we start fouling, right? When down at the end of the game, how much time is left? Like just determine it. And I would just say in general, I think teams wait way too long to adjust their their style of play when down, especially down, but down or up at the end of the game. So, you know, you're down 8 points at the end of the game. Most coaches would make a drastic change in their style of play. Actually, let me ask you that, Mark. And you're not you, because you're an outlier. When down at the end of the game, what would you say is down at the end of the game, but still like, it's not a blowout, right? I don't know what that number is for you. When down at the end of the game, but not a blowout, what, how much time left on the game clock would you say coaches start taking intentional fouls?
Under a minute, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. Under a minute. Have I shared the NHL hockey study with you before?
No.
Of pulling the goalie? Okay. So an economist, I can't remember the economist's name. It's not Oliver Basketball on Paper. It's a different economist, was a big hockey fan. And about 12 years ago, he started studying when NHL teams would pull the goalie. So when a hockey team is down at the end of the game, they actually pull the goalie to get another attacker on the floor to give them a chance of tying up the game. Obviously a high risk strategy because you're leaving an open goal and the other team could put the game away or win by multiple goals as opposed to just winning by one goal. And so he did the study and most NHL teams would also wait until under a minute to pull a goalie as a last ditch effort. He did a bunch of statistical analysis and found that the most statistically advantageous time to pull the goalie when down by one or more goals was with 4 minutes left in the game. And he's like, this is unbelievable. NHL teams need to know this. So he went to the Toronto Maple Leafs first because he was from Toronto and shared the information through some connections. And they said, oh yeah, we have that same data. We've been sharing it with our coaching staff for years, but they refused to do it. And so then he went to like the next NHL team and the next NHL team, they all had the same data and yet refused to implement and pull the goalie early. And so he's like, well, there's a new, more interesting study here. So he actually got on with a behavioral psychologist and they did a study as to why a coach would choose to act in opposition to what would give them a statistically greater chance at winning the game. And what they found was fear of lower status. If they did something different than every other coach was doing and it resulted in them losing, which is the most likely outcome regardless of your strategy when you're down one goal, right? If they did something different and still lost, they would have lower status in the eyes of their peers. And so they would rather lose the same way as everybody else as opposed to have a better chance of winning doing something different. And I think there's two really important lessons for savvy coaches in that analogy. One, in basketball, like in hockey, this is the tangible one. Change your strategy sooner when losing. In general. So for example, if your strategy is to intentionally foul or change up your defense or whatever it is, do it sooner. Most coaches wait too long. All right, that's the tangible one. But the thing that we can apply to everything, and honestly, one of the motivating beliefs as to why I started savvy coaching is I see this in coaches all the time. Do not allow fear of lower status keep you from doing the same things that everybody else does, losing and winning in the same way everybody else does, right? Like there's an investment strategy by Naval Ravikant, if you haven't read The Almanac by Naval Ravikant, you must read it. He's an asymmetrical thinker. And he basically says this, he says that concentration is how you maintain wealth, but variation is how you create wealth. Basically saying that if you already are wealthy, then just roll your money into a mutual fund or a 401k, roll it into the S&P 500, and you will maintain your wealth because of lower risk and whatnot. He said, but you do not ever create wealth through concentration or by doing what everyone else is doing.
Uh-oh, Tyler's paused. He freezed again. All right. While Tyler's frozen.
Mic check.
Yep, you're back.
Okay, I'll just finish it real quick, then you can go. Variation, taking multiple high-risk bets is the best way to create wealth. I would say it's the same way to have outsized returns on your level of talent as a coach. Taking multiple higher-risk bets or varying from the status quo of your league is your best chance to overachieve your talent. Whereas if you do what everyone else in your league is doing, you'll get what your talent gives you. So so what's tangible about this? If the majority of your league is playing zone defense, do not play zone defense, right? If the majority of your league is playing slow, do not play slow. If the majority of your teams in your league are playing three out, two in, high, low, you know, post-up game, don't play that way. That's your best chance of having outsized returns. Now, if you're the best team in the league, don't change anything, right? If you're the best team, right? But if you're trying to leapfrog someone, you got to take some bets.
Yeah, I will. Just ask this question, and it's applicable in the off season, is can we do what everybody else in the league does and win the league? If the answer is yes, you have the most talent. If the answer is no, why would you do what everybody else does in the league? You already answered the question, right? You can't win. Second thing, here's a formula. I'd be interested to, if you could be dead end, don't have to give thoughts if you don't have them, but comeback game formula, something that we used. The amount of time left in the game. So let's say 4.5 minutes to go. Round it up to 5. Add 1, 6. Multiply it by 2, 12. So if you're down more than 12 points, your comeback game starts then. If you're down less than 12, you can just ride it out. You have enough time to chip away. So that would be something tangible, a system in place. I had one assistant on my bench that was always logging comeback formula when we needed it, right? Not the entire game, but when it started getting crunch time, I could just look at him and just say, hey, what are we doing? And he's like, hey, the math says to do this. Again, how do we remove decisions? Have a system for those. So that's the comeback game formula. And then I have one question for you as we wrap up. You can only say yes or no, though. Foul up 3. Yes or no?
Yes.
Absolutely. I agree. Cool.
Comeback game formula. Mark, please work with Mabeth to get that as a post. I've never heard that before. I don't even know if I agree with the math, but I think that would be, it would trigger a really good conversation on Twitter.
All right. Let's do this real fast then. Let's math it. Round it up. Add 1, 6, multiply it by 2. How many coaches do you think go to their comeback game formula down 12 with 4.5 minutes to go?
Very few. More should. I actually don't think it's, I don't think it's far enough in the direction.
Big enough?
I don't think that, I think, well, I think the 12 number is too big. I would go into the, so like if I'm just going knee jerk again, I need to test this. This is just whatever. I would actually go, let's say there are 4.5 minutes to go. I would go into comeback formula, comeback game, if we were down only, and this is the way I feel I would trend it personally, if we were down only 6, which is drastic, I know. Yeah, and I guess I'm taking into, I'm thinking high school, and I'm taking into account pace of play, I'm taking into account like average scoring, like most high school games that I'm seeing right now, and even, I'd make it even more drastic for high school girls. Most high school girls basketball games are 40 something to 30 something. 6 points is percentage of total points scored, right? It's a lot. So I think there's a lot of other factors. Obviously they're like,
shot like clock 2 would be one,
right? Yeah. But yeah. So anyway, that's probably where my reaction. Now I would say that formula feels right for Division I college. I would probably, be more aggressive than that formula as I went down levels. If I'm going with my 12U girls team where we're winning 18 to 12, our comeback formula starts at halftime. Okay. So it's like, so yeah, it's an interesting conversation, but I love the formula and removing decisions. And I would love for us to get that posted and get into a conversation on Twitter.
Cool.
Gosh, that's good. All right. I'll share this with everybody as we get out of here. My wife's 9 months pregnant, so I bounced out of here. She's starting to have contractions right now. And Mark's like, he's like, yo, I think you should probably not be on the hours today. I'm like, Steph's a pro. She's good. I love doing this. This is like a highlight for me. So again, Mark, this is a highlight for everyone listening. Please, share this with somebody. Invite them to the community. we have a goal. Like, we want to impact the basketball world. We believe that these conversations have a positive impact. We want 1,000 coaches listening to this podcast every week. That requires a community membership. Please help us. If like, this is how you can grow the game. If this is making any sort of an impact on you, if we're impacting you, you also should make an impact. So whether that be you giving your time and energy to someone else, great, or just inviting them to, hey, check this thing out. I'll tell you a little secret, because I know you want to protect your investment. You can actually share this YouTube link to the hours with anyone without them having a membership, and they can watch it for free. I would ask that you don't do that regularly, but if you're trying to convince someone to join community, just share this link with them. They won't get everyone, because we share the links out privately to those of you that pay for it. But if you can help us convince another coach to invest $9.97 a month to spend hours with us, you're going to help grow the game. And if this has served you, then I trust you believe in it. So I'm just asking for your help. We want 1,000 coaches listening to this weekly by the end of the year. So please help us. And if you have an idea on how to help us, please send it over, because we believe that you're the type of coaches that want to grow the game. And thank you for investing with us. Mark, any final thoughts?
Nope. That's it. We'll see you either online at the Final Four or at a coach workshop.
Have a great one, everybody.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.